Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We're out here at State Fair. We're in Catonsville. We have the real Westmore, not the other Westmore, the real Don Mahler. I'm Nestor. We're eating shrimp and grits. We're getting ready. We're going to have Thiru Vignaraja joining us at Fadley's next week. We're back at Jennings as well. No one more positive than this guy. Look, I was crazy in segment one. This is your segment. I'm going to take segment three.
Well, Wes, you know, you have Wes. We could do 8 hours. But let me start with, and I wasn't going to do this, but I'm thinking about it now. One of the great, because you're so into what I'll call social entrepreneurship and social change. One of the greatest guests we've had, Wes, and I'm gonna go out on a limb, and I bet you know her, Sarah Heminger.
Oh, I adore her.
Well, that was about the safest question I asked.
I adore
her.
Tell
people from we talk about Thread literally every single week because we were supposed to do like we are with you about a 1 hour show. We ended up close to 2 hours.
Yeah.
We were in awe.
Yeah.
We couldn't stop. Tell folks, from your perspective, what Thread is doing in the city and the great work that Sarah's doing.
So Sarah is, I always tell Sarah, and she hates when I say this, but it's true. Sarah is the closest I will ever get to meeting Mother Teresa.
Right?
I adore
Sarah. And she's right here.
And she's right here in Baltimore. And she's fully committed to Baltimore. She's fully committed to Baltimoreans. I mean, she is just a remarkable, remarkable soul. And actually, I think the best description of Thread that I have heard is they remake family.
Right.
Right.
Well, I listened to you talk about community and family and going to the Bronx with your grandparents.
Yeah.
And they had expectations.
Yes.
I think Sarah used that word over and over and over.
That's right.
Being the product
what
of
was your thread?
Expectations.
What was your thread?
You know, actually, so
maybe you didn't have one early on after your father died. That was
But you know, I think that's actually one of the beautiful things about Thread is they say this concept of family is one that is constantly evolving, right? Where you have people who serve as parents and grandparents and siblings inside this relationship, but it's a constantly evolving thing. You have people who are going to be consistent. But at the same time, you have people who are going to always have add-ons because they understand different people are going to mean different things in our lives. And that's the thing. I think about my own life. Some of the most important people in my life and some of the most influential people in my life have been people who've been there the whole time. Some of them have been people who were there for a season. Or they were there for, you know, for 3 months.
Or a reason.
Or someone who I just had one conversation with, but I'm like, yo, that conversation just changed the way I'm thinking about my direction. Or
I got one guy in my life that's committed treason. That's changed my direction in my life.
Exactly.
So there you go. We're
exactly.
But you know, it's interesting, Wes.
That's the reason the show's here.
That's
if he's not president, I'm not doing this show and you're not here.
Wow.
Literally. Because it's inspired me. It's been so awful.
I'm feeling
that
real.
I needed
that.
To do something.
I love that.
I'm feeling
that's why we're sitting here on a Friday night.
I'm feeling really good this evening and very positive. We're
going
to do
up.
Our best to not talk about 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's see if we can do it, at least for
a second.
This is
a happy hour. How are we going to be happy? Can we not do that?
Oh, my God. We'll let you talk about it. But you talked about consistency.
Yes.
And it's interesting. One of the questions that Nestor and I asked Sarah was in her model, surrounding these young people with 4 or 5 volunteers to stay with them. We said, explain the 4 or 5. And without blinking, as you said, Mother Teresa responded, these kids have had enough disappointment. So if someone can't stick with the program and needs to fall to the wayside, I want to make sure we've got a fail-safe.
Yes.
And they still have 3 and 4 people who are caring about them before we fill in. I mean, it goes exactly to what
you're... I'm obsessed with saving souls and for all of us.
And Thread does, yeah.
And that's your mission is to that little boy in you that needed something, right? And we all need something different, right?
That's right.
And then how do we serve that? So what brings you here to this place after the war, after the book and all that success what called you to Robin Hood? And what is Robin Hood? I don't know if our audience knows.
Hey, Nestor, can we do this real quick? And I want to get to Robin Hood.
Sure.
But before you get to Robin Hood, I want to get, because I think your question is a great one. How did
you
get here? Wes, I'm blown away. Nestor and I are texting back and forth today. You're a very successful investment banker at Deutsche Bank in Germany.
Yeah.
And you wake up one day and say, I'm going to go become a paratrooper in Afghanistan. Now, walk us through this decision.
Well,
because
I mean, the other day, I believe, was Pat Tillman's birthday, right? Yeah. I believe it was. I saw some stuff online and people that were connected to him, and I knew a lot of people connected to him. He's a famous person that said, I'm going to go do this instead. And,
that's right.
And I don't know how many people do that.
Yeah.
I'm assuming maybe more than we know about. There are probably more people that at that point in Afghanistan or that point in life said, I need more fulfillment, right?
Yeah.
Money wasn't fulfilling you, right?
No. And I mean, and you think about, I think about some of the people who I admire most in the world. When people say, you know, living or dead, who do you admire? One thread that actually goes throughout all of them, and I never realized this until someone pointed this out to me, is sacrifice. It's people who actively are willing to sacrifice something. In some cases, in case of some people like Pat Tillman, sacrifice everything for what they believe in. And there's just something incredibly empowering and I think inspirational for me. And so I remember.
So you're in Germany.
Moment.
I mean, literally, you're a successful banker. You wake up. Walk us through the thought process.
So I first enlisted in the Army. In 1996, in fact, when I enlisted in the Army, I was 17 years old. My mother had to sign the paperwork because I wasn't old enough to sign it for myself. And only thing she really understood, because she really didn't read for the whole contract, was she thought it was just like an extension of military school. And she was like, oh, military school has been great for my son, so oh, this is more time. She had no idea she was signing me up for the Army.
This is not ROTC.
She was signing me up for the Army. And so I finish high school, and I go through all my basics and all that kind of stuff, and now I'm officially in the Army now. It's 1996. I decide pretty early.
Now, are you straightened out pretty good by now? I mean, going to the Army. I mean, you're not getting handcuffs anymore. We left you. You were 11 and getting sent off to Pensy Prep with Holden Caulfield.
That's right.
You're an honor student at this point.
At this point, I'm doing academic. I had basketball scholarship offers.
Right.
I was really doing well. But the thing that I knew was when I really thought about what did I enjoy, I enjoyed leading soldiers. Right. I enjoyed the military. I enjoyed that. And so when I thought about what I want to do, I said, I want to actually join the Army. I want to lead soldiers. And so I go through all my training. I get commissioned by 1998. And I'm now an Army officer in 1998.
Well, you were going apparently to go to college, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
This was the GI Bill, right?
That's right. And to get a commission, you had to actually have a degree. And it still applies now. You have to have a college degree to be an officer.
You saw the TV commercial in the football game. It says, what a great place. It's a great place. And you were going to go in and you were just going to, like, hang out in the military, do your thing.
Yes.
But you didn't think of yourself in a battlefield at that moment.
No.
You knew that was a possibility, right?
You knew it was a possibility, but listen, Nestor, you're
absolutely
right.
Does your mother know that when she signed up?
No. Remember, 1998. You had Kosovo. You had things. But that was an air war. That wasn't soldiers. We weren't reading about.
This is Clinton era, right?
This is Clinton era, right? So, but this was a relative era of peace. So when you sign up in the military, you didn't think
it was
that
like
moment.
The TV commercial.
Exactly, they're going to pay for college.
You're
going to
do push-ups
the year,
and
then obviously 3 years later, in 2001, the whole world changed.
Sure.
And 2001 was also the same time that I got the Rhodes Scholarship. I'm now getting ready to go off to England, and I'm talking to the Army the whole time. I'm like, so what am I supposed to do? My whole unit is now getting ready to deploy. And the Army's instructions to me were, we won't forget about you. Right now, what you need to do is fulfill this scholarship. You and all the other, we had West Point cadets, we had Naval Academy, midshipmen. Your jobs is to go finish your degrees, but we're not going to forget about you. I go, I finish my degree.
Did you owe them service?
I owed them service, but by that time, because of the service I had done, I basically paid back the service that I owed.
Okay.
Technically.
You were free if you chose to
be. If I chose to be.
Fair enough.
And I remember I was sitting there in investment banking, and one of my good buddies who at that time was a major is now a 2-star general, and he was a groomsman in my wedding. But one of my dearest friends, a guy named Mike Fenzel, he calls me up and he's like, "How's it going?" And I remember kind of as soon as I saw the phone, I hear him. I go to the alcove, and I'm sitting there, and my tie is draped down, and I'm like, "It's going good." Da da da. And he said something to me. He said, "So when are you going to get in the fight?" And that was so indicting. And I don't know if he realized how indicting, and actually he probably did, knowing Mike, how indicting that was for me to hear those words. Because now at that point, it's now 2003, Mike was on his second deployment. all these people who I trained with, all these people who I'd done, you know, airborne training with and became a paratrooper with, they're now deployed. They're now in Afghanistan. They're now, at that point, we're now just getting ready to start deploying to Iraq. And Mike asked me the question, so when are you going to get in the fight? And literally that night, I couldn't sleep. And you fast forward 2 weeks later, Mike and I are talking again. He ends up doing a by name request. I end up letting my job know I got to go. And I went back. I joined back up with the 82nd Airborne Division, went down to Fort Bragg, trained up, was down to Fort Benning, deployed from Fort Benning. And I'd say probably, 9 months after that phone call, I'm on my way to coast Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division.
How long were you over there?
About 13 months total.
So what, I know there's always talk of making the other West more a movie.
Yeah.
This in itself, it seems to me, is another movie. This whole decision and who and what you've become. One of our beliefs, Wes, in this whole discussion that we're having with folks, is that they're a composite of who they are. Yeah. That who we are today is just a whole jumble of stuff that we've been. Tell us about how that experience in Afghanistan formed who you are when you came out and who you've become.
In one way, it's a really good question. So in one way, I think it really triggered a level of activism around veterans issues that I didn't have before I went. I got very involved in a collection of veterans activism issues when I got back because I fundamentally felt like many of our paratroopers and soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, etc., I felt like we were being lied to.
Were you familiar with Vietnam veterans?
I was.
You know, I mean, when you signed up at 17, I guess it was 1995 at that point. There were a lot of Vietnam veterans at that point on the struggle coming back. Maybe it wasn't as loud, and there wasn't social media, and people didn't have the ability to say, the government screwed my uncle, or and it was would have always been your uncle, right? Yeah. Very rarely your aunt. Right?
That's right.
But now, you know, we hear horror stories at Fort Howard, you know, locally, for all of you who served us.
So now so you come back, and now you're saying, I got to get involved in veterans issues.
Yeah, and I tell you what, and actually the Vietnam piece is actually really important to me because I have all love and admiration for Vietnam veterans because I can tell you right now, the treatment we received was because for many Vietnam veterans, when they came home, they were like, never again. Like, we will never treat these warriors this way.
Well, 1985, they didn't know what PTSD was, right?
Well, that's right.
They were still trying to figure out Agent Orange, right?
That's right.
Literally.
But also, it's like, and they were right. It's like, I don't care what you think about the war. These are young men and young women who, when the country asked them to serve, they said yes. I don't care your opinion about the conflict. I don't care your opinion about the war. These men and women deserve your respect. Because when the country asked, they didn't ask the country to wait. They just raised their hand and they said, I'm in.
Now, what are we going to do for them when they come back?
And that's exactly right.
You know, when you talk about that, Wes, it's interesting, Nestor. You and I have never talked about this. And again, we see the age differences here. Back in the 70s, I was one of those college students in the streets going to Washington, protesting the war, having tear gas thrown at us. And when I look back at that, I don't regret the activism, but what I do regret is something you just said.
Yeah.
I don't think those of us who were involved in that movement did a very good job of differentiating the idea that men and women went when they were called versus what we saw as the immorality of the war.
Exactly. That lawmakers can make decisions that lawmakers make about how we deploy forces, where we deploy forces, when we deploy forces. That's their jurisdiction. That's their authority. That's the authority we give them. The most important title that we give to the occupant of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is not president. It's commander-in-chief, right? That is the most important title that they have, and that, honestly, is a weight that should sit on them every single day. Now, the person who's coming up in Dundalk, who's signing up and who's serving with the 323rd. The person who's coming up in West Baltimore, who's signing up and is now serving over at Fort Campbell. They're not the one picking and choosing which wars we decide to fight in. They're not the one picking and choosing which military maneuvers we're doing or which spots that we're going to, you know, we're going to lay arsenals towards. They're just simply executing on a job that our country asked them to do. And so the level of respect that we owe to them, that young man from Dundalk, that young woman from West Baltimore, that's a level of respect that is a solemn level of respect. We can protest the conflicts all we want.
Right.
And people should. People have the absolute right. Because also, as a citizen, we should be, I can tell you right now, and I tell you as a veteran, there is no one who is more cautious about when and how we use military, we use our military forces than I am. Because I know what war looks like, and it is ugly, and it is uncertain, and our families are the ones who pay the consequences for it. However, I will always be able to separate my feelings towards the people who are making the decisions and the ones who are then putting on the boots right. and going and executing these missions.
Well, how are we doing? And I'll ask you, and as we sort of move to the end of this segment, I'll ask you, how are we doing then in terms of how we're treating veterans? I mean, we hear about VA hospitals. We still hear some of the horror stories that Nestor alludes to.
Yeah.
You're still an advocate in that area. How are we doing, and what do we need to do better?
The truth is that we actually are doing better. And I think we're doing better because we've kept the pressure on. You know, we've reminded people.
It's awareness, awareness.
It's awareness. People have to understand. Mm. We're like, right now, as we are sitting here right now, there are missions going on overseas. There are men and women who are putting themselves in harm's way as we are speaking right now. And so it's reminding people that this stuff is still going on, reminding people that there is still very much a real need to be able to support these men and women and their families, because their families are as vulnerable in these situations as people while they're serving overseas. And then it's making sure that we're then aligning and being clear about what the need is and making sure that we're then giving them the supports that they need. So think about the advocacy issues that I worked on, whether it was the passage of the post 9/11 GI Bill, whether it was making mandatory medical and mental health services mandatory for the military, and you can't opt out or opt in, because frankly, everyone who deploys should go through medical and mental screening when they come back. Period.
For life.
For life. And they have earned that, and they deserve that. And then when you opt in or opt out, particularly when you attach it to things like your promotion records, it's completely unfair and doesn't make sense. Things like, you know, I was a big advocate for the lifting of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because I didn't understand, you know, it became very personal for me when I found out that one of my best friends, who I thought left the military because his time had run out, I later on found out that the reason that he left the military was because he decided to tell his commanding officer his truth, and they had him out in 6 weeks.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, you know, he was one of the best military officers I have ever known. I would trust my son or my daughter to serve under his command.
Well, he's going to ask you about Mayor Pete in the last segment, but before we do that, because I wrote this question down today, because I want to ask you this.
We're going to end this segment with this question that you wrote down. You never write anything down, so this is legendary.
I write everything down, but in these segments, it's all in here.
It's all in here. I don't need
Wes,
to. It's all in here.
You should feel good. Well, he never writes anything down, so I can't wait.
See, now you're going all light,
like,
and I got a heavy question.
I like y'all.
I got a heavy question. He thought I was going to ask what kind of beer he wanted.
Natty Bowes.
On the war thing, as a veteran, we all stand, we applaud every Sunday because someone came back and whatever.
Yeah.
Anybody tuning in, what would you tell them about war? What would you tell my audience about war and about going to war? What would you say? You've got a lot invested.
Yeah. The thing I would say about... The thing I would say about war is we have to appreciate the fact that just because people come back and they look like everything is fine and we're thankful that they came back in one piece, whatever that
means.
And
we want them to be fine.
And we want them to be fine.
We're cheering for them. We're hoping, right? Yeah.
I think the thing that people have to understand is that the experiences, the sights, the smells, it sticks with you and it stays with you. But the other thing I want people to understand about war and our warriors and these conflicts is, even though we have people coming back, not everyone will come back damaged. Everyone's going to come back different, right? Everyone will come back different.
Sure.
You cannot have that kind of experience and come back as the same person. But let's not go through this stigma that everybody is somehow irreparably damaged. It's not true. It's not fair. In fact, it is patently unfair. And so how I think we really focus on welcoming our soldiers back in real ways.
Well, I know that's been a real focus. I mean, your TED Talk was really about how to talk to someone that comes back, because we're not like the rest of you, and they don't know where to begin.
Yeah.
My wife's a two-time survivor. Most people are really afraid to ask her anything about it other than, are you okay?
Right.
Are you okay? Hey, how about the ball game? And
then they,
because they don't want to take you back to the war she was in,
the war
you were in.
That's right.
You know,
but then it makes it feel
like... That's
out
of respect to a large degree.
It is. And but it's also... But to the recipient, it'll almost feel like, are you asking the question for you or for me?
Right. Sure.
Because to the recipient who gets the, you know, are you okay? Cool. Or thank you for your service. Cool. It's almost like, did you say that because now you feel better? Or are you asking me because you really want to know my answer? Because if you really want to know my answer, I'm more than willing to talk with you about it and share it with you, because I think it's important for people to be able to share. But you know,
it's not easier that way, though.
Sort of
it's
like
not
that
easier it's, that way.
People come up and say, tell me about war.
Yeah.
People don't do that every day.
No,
I do that here at Baltimore Positive.
No.
But they don't ask you that.
And it's hard, because you're going to get very different opinions, very different perspectives, and you know, it's kind of these things, careful what you ask about,
because you never
know where people are going to go.
Well, it is like that old, it is like that old joke, right, where somebody walks up and says, hey, how you doing? And you start to answer, and you go, I didn't really want you to answer. I just wanted you to nod.
It's true.
I wanted you to nod. I didn't want to know how you were doing.
But I think, what ends up happening is that for a lot of people in these circumstances, because people are afraid to... I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to ask the wrong question. Or I just don't have time right now, so I'm not going to get into it. The interpretation for the person who has gone through the experience is, I don't think they even care. And so when you go through these kind of harrowing experiences, life-changing experiences, and whether it be battling an illness, whether it be combat, whether it be whatever it is, to walk around feeling like, but no one around me even seems to care, is another level of trauma that we're then asking.
Because you were doing it for them when you were there in the field.
That's exactly right.
Right.
That's who you were fighting for. That's who, when you were overseas...
You were fighting for my freedom to boo Donald Trump at Alabama tomorrow if I want to.
Here we go. We almost made it.
That's right. To honor your freedom of speech however you want to use it.
He was my high school God's counselor. I got to give him a hard time.
I'm just feeling too good. This is a Hall of Fame segment. I've even got
my Lamar shirt on. All right,
I knew this was going to go way too fast. We got one more segment.
Right,
where are we now?
We are at State Fair. We've already had shrimp and grits. We're going to get some meatloaf and some wings.
You're going to have a stout. I know you.
Not an omelet at this hour, but there will be a stout. Don Moeller, Wes Moore, the other Wes Moore. I'm Nestor. We are Baltimore Positive. Back for more in Catonsville right after this.